March is known for a thing called Ides. Spring shows up and turns the tides. Basketball tourneys, baseball where it's warm. I hope March for you is a shot in the arm. Welcome, everybody. This is Spectrum West. I'm Al Ross, the arts, culture, and humanities of Western Wisconsin. This week, a bluegrass album from Jim Nelson, retired elementary teacher who's always had music in his life one way or another, even during a pandemic. Did you know there's only one bluegrass song? And did you know that there's research into the effects of alcohol on the aging brain? UWEC psychology professor Doug Matthews will tell us all about that. The Beaver Creek Photo Club captures stunning wildlife shots. Many of them are hanging in the gallery at the Heide Center. Rick Koziel and Ryan Zimmerman are club members and our guests. And when actors need to accentuate, they turn to Susie Drager, you see. She teaches acting technique. Often dialect is a big part of it. The Midwest accent is humorous when exaggerated in movies and on stage. In April, the Chippewa Valley Theater Guild and Susie Drager will help actors become familiar with how we speak and ready if and when the role demands it. It's a free Saturday morning, and as always, I was nosy about a lot of things, so I called Susie. I wondered, to begin with, how acting became first a pet project, and then much more.
I started at about 4 years old. I was doing Suzuki violin. And right from the beginning, it was kind of comedy for me because I had a dog when I would practice my violin that would howl. And so for my first recital, I went out on stage, played my violin, and we brought my dog out and he's howled.
Cool.
So everybody else was, you know, playing violin, and here I came out and I'm like screeching and my dog is howling. And people laughed. I could have been tremendously embarrassed, but I actually liked it and kind of felt like I could ham it up a little bit.
Sure.
So that's really where it started. But I didn't audition and I wasn't in a play until I was in about ninth grade at South, and Fred Poss was doing little vignettes, like Andy Hardy vignettes, and and I had like a one-liner. That was it. Then just continued in high school, my junior and senior year of high school, and my senior year when you were deciding what you wanted to be, acting was it for me. And I went and auditioned at UW Stevens Point. I would have gone to UW Eau Claire, but my dad was a professor in the education department. Care Theater was right down the hall from his office, and I kind of wanted to spread my wings and have my own thing. I didn't want daddy looking over my shoulder.
Yeah, bless his heart. What goes through an actor's head on graduation day, college? Uh-oh, what's next? Or do you have stuff lined up? Because, you know, acting and music, those are the kinds of things that people come to you at a family reunion. How are you ever going to make a living at that?
Right.
What goes through your head when you're sitting there with your cap and gown on?
Well, I actually had a couple of advocates in my family. One of them was my grandmother in Omaha, Nebraska.
Good.
They had a neighbor who was heavily involved with the Omaha Playhouse. I did do an audition for them. I didn't get cast, but so I had people kind of looking out for me. There was also Wisconsin theater auditions at that time. My first professional gig was actually the summer between my freshman and sophomore year of college. I came back to Eau Claire and was at Fannie Hill, had gotten that through Wisconsin theater auditions in Madison. Then after college that summer, Stevens Point actually did a show that went up north from Stevens Point and performed up there. So I did that kind of that summer. And then I called Fannie Hill to kind of see what was up. And then I ended up being at Fannie Hill for a year after I graduated.
Okay.
Kind of came back.
Well, good for you.
Yeah.
And look what you're doing now. You're spreading what you know. So wonderful. Speaking of that, I received a card from the Chippewa Valley Theater Guild announcing some classes. And as I read it, I noticed your April training, which is a free class on Wisconsin accents. I'm one who's made my living by talking, and I've been keenly aware of the Wisconsin accent and the fact that it's real and it's noticed elsewhere. The upper Midwest accent. I watched some very funny videos. It's sometimes called North Central American English. I thought that was funny. There's also Upper English, Iron Range English, and more. It, as we all know, has been parodied in films like Fargo, which I read is called on the side Minnowegian. I thought that was funny.
Yep.
A Prairie Home Companion, the movie, another movie called New in Town. Folks like Sarah Palin have the sound because the Alaskan region where she grew up was settled by farmers from Minnesota. Where did this idea come from? Have you had to use that in a show or two? I guess I'm impressed with your ingenuity. Hey, I can do a class on this. And talk about fun.
Simply, Al, it came from, I'm on the education committee for the Chippewa Valley Theater Guild. They asked me to do that since I teach acting in the area. Uh-huh. And with the pandemic, you know, we haven't been able to perform. But how can we keep people engaged? And so we were kind of spitballing ideas, and I thought, you know, the very first thing I learned when I went off to college was they talked to us about our accent. Our professors were not from the Midwest. We had somebody from Philadelphia, somebody from the South, somebody from New York. They talked to us about that all the time, and that was kind of the first thing you learned, like, foundationally. And I thought, well, what if I just talked about our accents? Because when I went off to college, I didn't realize I had an accent.
If you didn't have an accent, a number of years in Stevens Point would have given you one.
I probably would put some D's on my TH's.
Uh-huh. We're on the phone with Susie Drager. She's an acting coach and a part of the Chippewa Valley Theater Guild putting on a free class on Wisconsin accents. In fact, it's Susie doing it, and it's Saturday, April 17th. We'll find out how to take part in just a minute. Over the weekend, I read a lot of stuff. I uncovered so much more than I realized was out there. There's a book, actually, called How to Speak Midwestern. I saw a video by the guy who wrote that book talking about the disses and the dems and the does. He was saying that you don't hear it as much in people under 50. He attributes it to comedy bits. The younger people don't want to be identified that way. They work at it. I also was watching a video in which a couple of ladies were talking about a thing called accent prestige theory. People with accents cause different impressions. A British accent will label you as being smart. A Southern accent, not so smart. I also watched a video of a young guy on YouTube ranting about how much he hated his Midwestern accent. And he said the only accent uglier than the Midwestern accent is the redneck South accent. And he said that one sets off my fight or flight response. I just had to laugh at that. As you and I talked when we were setting up this conversation, Charlie Behrens, of course, is fast becoming purveyor of the Midwestern accent. In fact, I watched a video in which he has a bottle opener that can translate.
I actually show that video in my class. That's funny.
And a can koozie that will inject the accent into your favorite movies. Susie, what's a basic lesson in learning the accent like? I would guess most actors will already have it, as you just said, but there are ways to enhance it?
Yeah, I mean, you just heard me say, yeah.
Yeah.
So that's part of my accent that has trouble going away and that sometimes an outside source has to point out to me, you're saying yeah instead of yes. Basically, we start by working on the vowels.
Yeah, some of the stuff I saw blames the long A and the long O, you know.
Yeah.
And like your last name, Drager, that could be a good teacher of the long A thing.
And that's kind of fun because that's one thing we do in the class is we say our name with our accent, okay?
Oh, cool, yeah.
So my name is full of it. Susie. So we've got Susie. And then Drager, where you kind of chew that A.
Sure.
Whenever there's a diphthong, we tend to chew it. So, and then the R at the end, you know, it's Drager. We kind of close that vowel off. The first time I presented this class, we had a student named Jill. And Jewel, you kind of lose that I a little bit and it kind of gets swallowed.
Sure.
Yeah, chewing and swallowing is a big deal.
And we Midwesterners, we like to take shortcuts on words.
Oh, yeah.
Like Chippewa, you know. You can tell when an announcer on the radio is not from around here because they give it all three syllables.
My father, who's from Nebraska, says Chippewa to this day.
We should actually say it that way.
Probably.
If I were to say Chippewa, they'd go, where's that guy from? Chippewa Falls. You know, that's just how it goes.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, the other thing, oop, we do a lot of like, oop. I noticed that instead of whooped, it's oop.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't know if oop was shortened from whoops, but.
Well, I don't want to take the fire away from what you're going to be doing on the 17th of April. We gave enough hors d'oeuvres away, and I think it sounds like it's going to be a lot of fun, and I hope a lot of people get involved. So how do we get involved? How do we partake of this thing on Saturday, April 17th?
Basically, you can just email the Chippewa Valley Theater Guild. There's a Facebook page, but I believe it's CVTG act@aol.com and just email and say you'd like to be a part of the class.
And what time is this?
It's at 10 a.m.
Okay.
So you get to sleep in.
One thing I loved when I was doing all my research over the weekend, could have been a radio person, mildly embarrassed when being introduced as having come from the Midwest, and instead of calling it a polka, he called it ethnic jazz.
Oh, no, really?
Yeah.
It is neat to see who's from the Midwest, though. I mean, like, a lot of people don't know that Mark Ruffalo is from Wisconsin.
Well, there you go.
You know, we talk about Charlie Behrens, but, you know, Spencer Tracy from back in the day. That's why I mentioned Spencer Tracy, because Tracy and Hepburn, they're one of the reasons I wanted to act. Wonderful chemistry.
Sure.
Yeah.
You got to find that male counterpart then if you're going to be that legendary. You have a lot of time. Susie, thanks so much. Appreciate it. And it sounds like a lot of fun. And I hope that you will let us know all the things you're doing and shows you're in. And we look forward to hearing from you.
Well, thank you, Al. Thanks for the time.
Bye then.
Bye then.
Everything you need to know is at cvtg.org, Chippewa Valley Theater Guild. See? Chippewa, right there. Got it. Coming up, some homegrown bluegrass, leading UWEC research, and next, a wild photo exhibit in Chippewa Falls. Chippewa Falls. Support for WPR comes from Marquardt Toyota, committed to delivering an authentic and enjoyable automotive experience. Marquardt Toyota is located off Highway 53 between Eau Claire and Chippewa Falls and at MarquardtToyota.com. Support also comes from UW Health Breast Center, providing second opinions for those diagnosed with breast cancer in person or on video via telehealth. More is at uwhealth.org/second opinion. Beaver Creek Reserve is a natural when it comes to marvelous things to do, and activities will hopefully get back to normal sometime in 2021. Beaver Creek also has a photo club, and members have shot some stunning nature and wildlife shots over the years. Some of the best are currently on display in the gallery at the Heide Center for the Arts in Chippewa Falls. Retired BCR director Rick Koziel is a photo club member, and Ryan Zimmerman is president. We met in the gallery with the echo and everything, and Rick began with a brief photo club history.
We started in the 80s sometime, I'd say mid-80s. About that time, we started producing a calendar at the reserve, a phenology calendar. We took photographs from local people and then added some phenology, you know, what's happening in the natural world, and started producing that calendar. I think it was in 85, 84, something in that range. That's when really the club started, shortly after that.
Beaver Creek had, and may again, maybe they're not because of the situation we're in, had its own exhibit and awards.
Yes, yeah, and that program actually went on until
this year.
They are now discontinuing the calendar. 2020 was the last year of it. Although, talking to Eric, new director there now, they're looking for some other ways to continue the calendar type project, have the contest and use the pictures online to provide phenology to people. They're still working on some ways because some people have been upset that they're not doing it.
Yeah. What better place to have, first of all, a photo club and then calendars, et cetera, than a nature center? All right. So, Ryan, the Heide Center release says the photo club is nature-centric, quote unquote. And I don't see any photographs here that really aren't nature-centric. But there are no limitations on photos. What's not nature-centric, I guess, is my point.
There's lots of different things. In the past, we've had members that are into railroads or planes.
Okay.
There's a lot of portrait photography that's out there. Most of us are big into using longer zoom lenses and capturing nature, but we do have some urban photography, and it's really neat stuff. And it's more about techniques and learning from the other photographers. How they get the shot that really helps our club grow.
What's your history with photography? Why are you president of the photo club? Are you like a well-known shutterbug?
And we always joke that I'm president by default. I keep trying to to get somebody else to run against me, but nobody really wants to, I think. But
you'll be president for a while.
He's president for life.
That's the rumor I've heard. I got involved through another member, it's been about 10 years. My photography skills were probably the lowest in the club when I started, and they probably still are, but they're a lot better than they used to be.
He's shaking his head. He thinks you're pretty good at it.
Well, I've gotten a lot better. The club has made me a better photographer, and you come to a meeting and the photographers in our club are showing their work, and you're kind of a little intimidated. Not our intent, but it is what happens. But the more you try and the more you listen and learn techniques, the better it gets. We're a pretty small club, so a lot of members contribute, and it works really well.
The exhibit is called More Than Just a Photo. The biggest thing we need to admit nowadays is, since the advent of cell phones, everybody's a photographer.
Everybody.
Yes, yeah.
And we take some of the best photos because they're spontaneous.
Oh yeah, the phones are excellent. I mean, if you think about the beginning digital cameras that we went out with, their point and shoots, the phone camera you're carrying around is 100 times better, and the quality is unbelievable, and they're better at low light. There's just a lot of things you can do with them. There's filters you can put on them. So, yeah. And most of us don't use our phone for our exhibit photography, but I've seen great shots from iPhones and Android phones.
You're not so elite you don't go to members and say, we don't accept cell phone pictures.
Oh, no, absolutely not. Actually, sometimes the photos on the cell phones are of us in the field taking pictures. Sagzim Bog up north, I've seen several of their cell phones, sunsets and sunrises. Sometimes that's all you can do if you got the wrong equipment on the body for a close-up. You need your cell phone for a wide angle.
And that's the cool thing about photo clubs, I guess. Yes, you're going to get better shots if you have a nice telephoto lens, but it doesn't matter the equipment you have. Photography is in the eye of the person.
Exactly.
Yeah, and the best equipment in the hands of somebody who doesn't take into account composition or light is pretty much worthless. So, if you work at it and you learn with your equipment, you can take some amazing photos.
And the other amazing thing, given the technology we have, is the ability to enhance photographs. I would think photo clubs in the last 10, 20 years, that's got to be one of the neatest things, all the wonderful things you can do digitally.
Yeah, there's some amazing Photoshop plugins, other plugins too for different companies, but you can take a photo and make it look watercolor, mm-hmm. like somebody painted it. The advantage of shooting raw is you can make up for a technique flaw, but you can also do some really neat stuff, the HDR stuff. You can stack, exposure stack, you couldn't do that in a darkroom real easily.
Ryan Zimmerman, president of the Beaver Creek Photo Club, and Rick Koziel, who's just a friend of everybody's. They're both with us here in the gallery at the Heide Center in Chippewa Falls. There's an exhibit featuring work by the Beaver Creek Photo Club members up now through April 2nd. Since the beginning, photography's always been the art form that maybe more than others presents a story behind what the eye can see. The word capture has always described taking a photo. It stops time and immortalizes that moment. Photography is an art form. It's always been said, especially with artwork, beauty's in the eye of the beholder. A lot of the shots that I see here, they're kind of spectacular shots. And there is captured, using that word again, motion. But then some of the other ones are pretty serene. Let's say you were a nature photography judge. Does wonderful snowy owl in flight beat fawn lying in the grass? Or are they different categories?
A lot of times they're categorized. Okay. Landscapes versus wildlife, mammals, birds. And you're right, it's definitely subjective when you start to compare between the genres, so to speak. And I think when people look at a photograph, when they're judging, they're looking for specific things like sharpness, depth of field, how much of it is in focus. Birds in flight, for example. It's really easy to get a piece of the bird in focus,
sure.
But can you get the wingtips? I think they use a lot of those criteria. Composition's probably a big piece of it. Lighting, those are things that they look at when they judge stuff.
And I think it goes back to the individual. I can remember judges out for our Beaver Creek contest. Usually we would take the pictures that they thought were award-winning, put them up on the stage, and then they'd come by to rank these pictures. And in a category, you might have 5 or 10 different pictures, and I'd have the judges rank them from 1 to 10. And there was not uncommon to have one judge rank a picture one in the category and the other judge rank a 10 in the category. Yeah. And I think, you know, the action pictures that you see here, birds in flight and, you know, bears catching salmon, those are really hard to capture to get an image like that. So when I look around and I see those types of things, they appeal more to me. You know, I like to see images that are showing action or showing some of the behavior of my subject.
And then when you look at the opposite spectrum, the landscape, when you're catching an action shot, you're at the mercy of the subject, but there's very good landscape photographers in our club, and you know that takes time and dedication to set up your scene and scout the location and know when the sun's going to be in the right spot, you know. And you can go out there and sit for a week and not get the right cloud cover or whatever you need to get that shot. So landscape photography is a patience game, if you ask me.
Yes.
There are stories behind the photographs. That's what I'm reading about this exhibit. Yeah. How did you get this? And they have a story.
You know, I've taken tens of thousands of images over the years, and when I see one of my pictures, I can probably tell you exactly where I took that, when I took it, and what was happening at the time. I mean, that's how much that brings back to me is when I look at an image.
I think that's one of the exciting pieces of our club is when we meet every month, we talk about what it took to get the shot or what technique we used and, you know, how exciting it was, you know. Yeah. Rick will talk about his trips out to Yellowstone, and we went a different time of year, and we didn't see what we normally see, and looking at one direction, and the next thing I know, right behind me, something happens, or, you know, and that's the kind of stuff that makes the club unique, is the sharing those stories, and it's not just about the technical aspects of photography, it's the connected piece of it.
So here we are sitting in an exhibit. What are the other benefits of membership?
So we meet once a month, fourth Thursday of the month. Right now it's virtual. We do a Zoom meeting. We bring in photos to share. A lot of times we'll get a video or guest presenter, and then we kind of share our photos from that month. We share and we talk about them, and people ask questions about technique or, hey, how did you do that? What were your settings when you caught that? How did you stop the bird's wings or those kind of things? Other benefits, I think, is you just learn new techniques. We learn new locations, places to go, local and further away. We participate in the Wisconsin Photographic Society of America club contests, judged by all the submitting clubs.
There's what, 10 or 12 clubs?
13 were in the last one, so 12 other clubs that we compete with. Out of 100 photographers submitted into this contest, we've had the number one photo from our club in the last 2 years.
The bottom line, though, is not to win awards. You're taking photographs because you see what you see and you're amazed by it and you want to capture it.
Yeah, I love being outdoors. I'm taking pictures for myself. I'm not taking them for anybody else, you know, but I enjoy it.
Yeah, I'm running out of wall space at home.
And I think next year in the exhibit, there should be a still that you take of all the members in a Zoom meeting.
Oh, yeah, we could do that.
That would be a natural photograph, wouldn't it? Ryan and Rick, thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You want to join the club? Email them at bcrpc@outlook.com or Google Beaver Creek Photo Club and just hit the website. And for viewing the exhibit, just don your mask and head for the hill, the Heidi Center. Some of the art is for sale, too, and would look great on your family room wall. And here's a reminder, tomorrow, March 5th, is the deadline for registration in the 57th Annual Spring Art Show at the Heidi Center. At this late date, you might want to give them a call at 726-9000. You're listening to Spectrum West on WPR. Thanks for doing so. I read a release from UW Eau Claire about some research being done carrying the implication that alcohol has unique effects on the aging brain. Having a noodle that matches that description, along with my enjoyment of an occasional bubbly adult beverage, naturally, I selfishly said, I think I'll look into that. Dr. Doug Matthews is a psychology professor who spearheads the research. We witnessed and distanced in a Hibbard Hall classroom, and I began with some observations about psychologists.
You guys must be really centered. You don't lose sleep. Well, you have your highs and lows, but you could never get manic. Do psychologists feel like they're in control?
You know, what I would probably say, for the most part, I feel like I can manage my life and my environment okay. Now, if you asked my wife, you'd get a different opinion. And if you asked my teenage daughters and my early 20 daughters, you'd get a fundamentally different opinion. You know, I think it's one of those things that simply because you can give a scientific definition to what you're thinking doesn't stop you from being able to have that reaction or whatever it be, you know?
Man, talk about being behind the eight ball. Imagine being the child of a psychologist. You couldn't question the thing they did or said.
Well, they did. My kids did.
Tell me about UW-Eau Claire research teams. How are they put together?
The research teams at Eau Claire are really unique from any other university I've been at before. The teams are made up of faculty and then undergraduate students. We don't have many graduate students at Eau Claire. What we do is in targeted programs. So before I came here, I would train doctoral students and I would spend all my time on their research. But since coming to Eau Claire, it's a faculty member and undergraduates ranging from their first semester in college to somebody who's been here and getting ready to graduate. The ones in my lab typically start off because they've had me in a class and they are interested in what I've talked about, or they're interested in a career down the road that research experience would be really helpful, and they stop by my office and want to know if I have openings, and we start a conversation off that.
And you also have, and it's important in what we're going to talk about, the specific topic, a partnership with Mayo Health System.
I do.
Does that partnership kick in with individual projects, or is it an ongoing thing?
It's been ongoing for my lab for about 3.5 years now. My lab is heavily funded by Mayo Healthcare, and I'm incredibly grateful for that. The projects that we work on really leverage expertise that my lab has and a laboratory, Dusup Choi's lab at Rochester, has. Students have participated in their summer research program. A student of ours getting ready to graduate is going to pursue a PhD in neuroscience down there. So it's really one of those things. It's not just the involvement in working on the science together. It provides an opportunity for UW-Eau Claire students to be engaged with what is one of the world's best research centers.
Mm-hmm. Research that you guys are involved in, the effects of alcohol on older brains, to put it in layman's terms, and I'm a layman. And you know, when you begin research, sometimes there's a hypothesis and you set out to prove or disprove it. Other times you're starting just out of curiosity from square one. And other times discoveries happen during the course of investigating something else. This particular bit of research is part of the latter.
It is, yes.
You happened on something.
We did. We were heavily involved about a decade ago in investigating the response of alcohol in adolescents compared to adults. Most people begin experimenting with the drug when they're an adolescent.
And you're on a college campus.
And we're on a college campus, so it was a natural question for us to ask. I was at Baylor University at the time and was working with a graduate student, and we decided to include a group of older rats. They were about 18 months old. I think for a human, somewhere here is maybe 65, 70 years old, okay. Something like that. And we were doing a very simple behavioral experiment, and the results were so startling in the older animals. It was like one of those moments where you sit back and you're like, I didn't expect that. That was so much of a larger effect than what we thought we would get, that it really shifted the focus of the laboratory.
How often do students of yours hand something to the pros, the Mayo people, that's mildly groundbreaking?
You know, I've been doing research for 25 years. And this is probably one of the most groundbreaking things that I've ever seen.
I used mildly because I didn't know how to label it.
So part of what's going on is the federal government is interested in funding research in older individuals because the population is aging, right?
And yes, we are.
Yeah, right. And understanding the health consequences of older people is important. For example, I was talking with a researcher down at Mayo yesterday, and they have a set of tissue of ours, two different brain regions collected with the help of three different UWEC undergraduates. The research that's being done down at Mayo with that tissue now is a technique that involves equipment that is multi-million dollars, and they have the world's expert at doing neuroproteomic research. And the data that we should get this week has never been reported before in the history of science.
Wow.
You know, so the chance for an undergraduate to be able to be part of that and handle data that is truly unique to all of the scientific endeavor just doesn't seem to happen all that much. I've never done it, and I've been in this for 25 years.
Yeah.
To do this as an undergraduate is just amazing.
You said something about tissue. Are we still talking rats, or are you working on humans?
Yeah, so this is rat tissue still.
Okay. Is Mayo able to take it to a human level from the things you hand them, or where is the research now?
Yeah, you know, that's a really good question. The best human brain bank is actually in Australia, and they do ship tissue to other researchers around the world. There is such little work done in the older population with alcohol. To be honest with you, there's only a few different labs that look at it, so we don't have a whole lot of information.
Okay.
Now, if you ask that question in 5 or 7 years, my guess is there'll be significantly more information there.
Those 5 to 7 years you just mentioned, do you feel as if it could very well be this particular bit of research might be at the top of the heap in what is found in those years?
Yeah, that's a great question. That's my hope. You know, it's my hope because one of the things that I think is really great about this is that the work that's done at UW-Eau Claire really captures a lot of the behavioral nature of what is an alcohol use disorder and that aspect of it. The work that's being done at Mayo is cutting-edge molecular biology. It's not just that the work they're doing with the tissue is the exciting stuff that Big Ten, ACC, West Coast universities would be doing. They are developing the statistical tools at Mayo to actually be able to analyze the data. They are the world's best at it. Uh-huh. So to be involved in that is just incredible.
We're in a classroom on the UW-Eau Claire campus and enjoying a conversation with Dr. Doug Matthews. He's a professor of psychology, and he and students, along with a partnership with Mayo Health System, are working on some research. Quite exciting. The effects of alcohol on older brains. I don't think we've defined what you found out so far. What are some of the effects on older human beings with the consumption of alcohol?
You can look at it in a couple of different ways. One is acute alcohol. So just imagine, you know, you don't drink all that often, and then you sit down and you have a couple of drinks. What happens there?
Uh-huh.
Okay. One of the things that really caught my attention was the state of Wisconsin. It's the highest number of older individuals that are hurt or die from a fall. And when I read that, the first thing I thought of was ice, snow. I mean, I fall in the winter, right? But when we began following up with our research, aged animals are just significantly more sensitive to the effects of alcohol. If we give them a task where they have to coordinate their movements and things like that, they're awful at it. So that's probably some of what's contributing to the older population. Cognitive effects, we have cognitive decline as we go into 70s, 80s, into 90s. Alcohol use seems to increase or exacerbate that effect. And then the work with Mayo is really looking at chronic alcohol exposure in aged animals. And at least the preliminary data seems to suggest that the aged brain is more at risk to developing behaviors which resemble an alcohol use disorder than, say, the adult brain is.
Uh-huh.
And older people continue to drink. In fact, they probably, recent data suggests they binge drink at greater quantities than adults do for a variety of reasons. So trying to understand, is the older individual more at risk of developing an alcohol use disorder, is really where we're at and what we're focused on.
Here's a kind of a philosophical question. We need to meld philosophy with science.
Sure.
I'm wondering how far your research goes into the situation. For instance, it's stated that alcohol consumption is high in Wisconsin. That led me to wonder about, this could be a general question, maybe not even applicable to the alcohol situation that you guys are researching. What is the responsibility of research? And I'm wondering if there is such a thing as research responsibility. If I think broadly about that, the responsibility of research is to simply find out why things happen, which is the scientific side.
Sure.
Or to offer solutions after finding out, after coming to conclusions, which is the social or the moral responsibility. Or do you simply hand off your findings to others to come up with how to use it?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. Depending on who you're asking, you're going to get a different answer, answer. So I'll just give you mine.
Right? Right, yeah.
I believe that one of the things that science should do is answer the question of what's going on, okay? How is the system impacted and that kind of stuff. The other thing, though, I believe is, you know, I work at a public institution, and my paycheck is paid by the taxpayers of the state of Wisconsin, and I try to never forget that. So I think it's important to be able to take the data that we have and be able to disseminate it to the general public and say, this is what we found. These are some of the factors that might be important, and be honest about that. It would be easy for me to say and design studies where it showed alcohol bad, but that's not the whole story, right? There's a lot of data that show low levels of alcohol consumption actually seem to convey a health benefit to people, may convey a health benefit as we age. And I think it's important to be honest about that and be able to show the full knowledge to people. The other thing that we do, and I have my undergraduate students do this. In fact, they're doing it this week. I go to the local middle schools and high schools, and I make presentations on neuroscience or alcohol use. But I also have my undergraduates do that. So one's going to talk to Regis, another one's going out to Osseo, another one's going down to Altoona to talk. You know, because I think it's important for us to convey information to the public and then say, you know, the policies of how science impact life is determined by politicians, which is determined by people who vote. So I think as we educate people on what we found, people can make a better informed decision.
Mm-hmm. The past year must have had a big impact on students looking to pursue scientific research and medical-related careers, and because the spotlight's been on your field.
Yeah.
And I also wanted to bring up the fact that, and you have brought it up several times, these are undergraduate students. They're not so far along that they can't be wowed by what it is they're doing. So right. they're able to see all this stuff they're doing and the collaboration. It has to solidify commitment to keeping that going. Is that where they should be learning this stuff and having this experience?
Higher education's changing. We're in a transition period in higher education. One of the things that I think happens, and I think it happens great at Eau Claire, we emphasize this faculty undergraduate research in whatever the discipline is. You know, so if you're working in art and music, it's going to look different than if you're working in neuroscience. But the concept of scholarship is the same. A quick story of Samantha Scaletti from Appleton, Wisconsin. 4 years ago, showed up as a first-year student in an intro to neuroscience class of mine. She took it because it fit her schedule. Fell in love with the discipline, joined my lab that fall. In the 4 years she's been at Eau Claire, she's published 2 peer-reviewed papers. She's gone to 3 or 4 different conferences. She's done summer research internships at the University of Illinois and Mayo Healthcare, and she's going down to Rochester to study for the PhD in neuroscience. You know, I think the ability to be able to leverage being involved in these labs with amazing research facilities changes students' lives, and that's what we really want to be about. Give them opportunities and let them run with it.
Speaking of running with it, the Blue Gold Biomedical Innovator Program, what is that?
As our chancellor would say, this audacious idea of making UW-Eau Claire the preeminent undergraduate institution to study for pre-med. And that's a great idea. It's a lot of words. But Mayo Healthcare has put behind it a substantial amount of money to fund 10 bioinnovators per year. They get a Fulbright scholarship. High-achieving students out of high schools, and they come direct admit into a laboratory. Amazing students. They come in, and on day one, they start working in my laboratory. They get the experience on the run. It's almost like drinking from a fire hose, and they're incredible. The goal is for these individuals to have 4 years of great experience and then go into a healthcare field.
Well, all I can say in conclusion is thanks for your important work.
Thank you.
We look forward to hearing about findings as they become evident.
Thanks.
You can do that?
I will, sure.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Always feel better about the road ahead after talking with professionals like Dr. Doug Matthews and colleagues teaching young people at schools on all levels. Why, if this were television, you would see me grinning. Spectrum West on WPR, where support for WPR comes from Charter Bank of Eau Claire, offering the mobile app that provides access 24/7 to view balances, pay bills, and more. Available on iPhone, iPad, and Android. More is at charterbank.bank. We also receive support from Peace Coffee, providing fair trade organic coffee by partnering with small-scale coffee farmers around the globe. Available at grocery stores throughout Wisconsin and online at peacecoffee.com. As a retired elementary school teacher, you might say Jim Nelson has some time on his hands. As a musician in a band during a pandemic, you might say that time has migrated from his hands to other extremities. It was a regular day, except for COVID, when he had the sensation that it was time to do a bluegrass album. So he did. With the virtual collaborative help of friends and even pickers he has yet to meet,
If you're like me, like the fruitcake legend, you swear there's only one bluegrass song. Turns out Jim's like me.
My baby says she's gone to Oklahoma. Like a freight train running down a one-way track. I wonder why she's gone to Oklahoma. I wonder if she's ever coming back.
You retired from teaching elementary school a couple years ago.
Yeah.
And you've done a bunch of music since then, some of which we'll get into. But I was curious if you ever integrated your music and guitar playing into the process of educating young people.
Oh, absolutely. Especially back in the beginning, I was teaching younger grades. I taught kindergarten for 4 years in second grade, and I would usually have my guitar sitting there in the classroom. I had a guitar that was dedicated, just left it at school, and... You know, at informal times and group times and morning times, I'd pick up the guitar and we'd sing some songs. So that was always something that I tried to bring. As I moved through my career and the students got older, I kind of moved up the ranks. And, and then it was less and less, but definitely in the early years.
What a rock star Mr. Nelson was, I'll bet.
Yeah, I guess.
I like to talk with people about their histories with their instruments. How about your history with the guitar? I listened to your Still in the Band song, and it mentions long hair, etc., so I'm guessing that your relationship goes back at least a little bit.
Well, yeah, I've been playing guitar probably, I would say, since I was about 13, 14 years old, 40-some years ago. My older brother had a guitar sitting around, and he never played it, and I picked it up, and my parents got me guitar lessons, and I had one guitar lesson, and then my guitar teacher moved away. The rest of it was self-taught. I'm since finding out I probably could have used a few more guitar lessons and learned things the right way, but yeah, I've been playing a long time. It's always been a hobby, something I do for fun.
What's your hometown?
I grew up in the Twin Cities, Golden Valley.
As a teenager, the Twin Cities had to be a great place to live.
Yeah.
A lot of music.
Absolutely. A lot of concerts. I remember the first concert I ever saw was the band Chicago.
Ooh.
Down at the old Met Center, where the Mall of America is now. Saw The Who at the St. Paul Civic Center and saw Bruce Springsteen a few times. These are all just because my brothers were into that, and they let me tag along.
It's funny how when you're a young person, you know, you go along, you can let the guitar sit for a while, and then you end up going to a concert, and then you're back playing the guitar.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, you see somebody else playing, and you go, yeah, I'm going to pick that up, too. Yeah, you're right.
You were nice enough to send me kind of an armchair bio, and I appreciate that because it gave me the names of some of the bands that you've been in. You play in a band now, although probably not much lately, and you've had that for quite a while. I like to dissect band names. Where did the Cutaways come from?
The structure of an electric guitar, you know, that little rounded-out part when you go up the neck. To make room for your hand is called a cutaway.
I knew that. I just didn't know that anybody would name a band after that little groove there. On the phone with Jim Nelson. He's a retired school teacher, and man, he plays in a lot of bands and has over the years, and he's got a wonderful new CD out produced with friends. It's called There's Only One Bluegrass Song. Four albums of original stuff since retiring, I read. Most of them, if not all of them, done at home. That's fun stuff, and I think maybe you and I are old enough to kind of marvel at the ability to do albums at home. The album New Morning from 2020 sounds pandemic-y to me. What was that all about?
That is exactly what it was supposed to sound like, because that's what it is. That started almost a year ago, right at the end of March. As soon as the whole state country went into the lockdown, I started thinking about what it would be like when we came out of lockdown.
Mm.
The actual song, the title song, New Morning, came from that thought, thinking, oh, this is what it's going to feel like when we go outside that first day. Because, of course, back then, the thinking was one day it's just all going to be over and everyone's going to be able to get to go out and say hi to people, and it's going to be a new morning. Then the rest of the songs just sort of came to me. They're all sort of pandemic related. That is the intention. It was, again, recorded here at home, and it's a lot less polished than the other ones because it was something I just did. But I better get this out before the pandemic is over. You know, this was getting into be April already, and I thought, this is going to be over soon. I better get this CD out before the pandemic ends. And, of course, I did not need to hurry.
No, as it turns out, you had time, yes. And soon we'll have the new morning.
I hope so. Yep.
As I alluded, the current album is bluegrass. Have you been able to play a lot of bluegrass over the years, or was this album something that you said, you know, I have not done a lot of bluegrass, let's do one?
To be honest, I have not played a lot of bluegrass. I have never played in a real traditional bluegrass band. I've always been a casual fan of bluegrass music. I enjoy listening to bluegrass. I really come at it more as a guitar player, so I like a lot of the, you know, the flat picking guitar flavor of bluegrass. Every once in a while I'll write a song or something and it'll sound more bluegrass than anything else. So a lot of these songs have been around a long time, and then some of them are getting their first bluegrass treatment, but it's not something I've ever performed.
There's only one bluegrass song, which is the name of the bluegrass album, is also pandemic related because it was produced in such a way, well, I suppose going forward a lot of people will produce their music this way because they discovered how easy it is.
Yeah.
But you did it because you had to do it this way. You literally had songs and you sent stuff to people and they recorded their parts and sent it to you, and then you put it together on your system.
Yes, that's exactly correct. I just thought, hey, this guy, Royce Sorensen, I had known his name. I've never met Royce. We produced a CD together, but I've honestly never met him before. This was probably in October of 2020, a few months ago. I just said, I'm just going to email Royce and see if he's interested in a project like this. I knew he was a bluegrass player. I knew he had a studio in his house. So all that was left was whether or not he would be interested in doing something virtually, sending tracks back and forth, one tune at a time. I'd send him a song, he'd record his parts, and then he'd send me his parts, and I'd put it together, then I'd send him another one. It was sort of a one-at-a-time kind of deal. And then when I got to about 10 songs, I said, all right, that's good.
Going forward, I have a feeling music will be produced this way. There are a bunch of really good but very shy musicians out there who just may not perform as well in a studio in front of other people, even if it's just an engineer on the other side of the glass. Now, look at this. I can do this in my house with only my dog watching, and we have a wonderful product. There was speculation about a pandemic baby boom. I believe I've read that has never really materialized, but there is music that is the direct result of our predicament, and that's how it's produced.
Yeah.
We've talked about silver linings for the last 11 months, now 12 months.
Right.
And I guess that's probably one of them. The first song and the name of the album sort of says it for me. I contacted you about doing this interview via email, and I expressed a sentiment to you.
Yeah, you said that you were a guitar player and a casual bluegrass fan, but all the music kind of starts to sound the same after a while. And then I sent back to you chuckling that I sort of have that same feeling, and that's kind of where the title of There's Only One Bluegrass Song came from, the quote-unquote joke about there's only one bluegrass song. They all sound the same. A lot of people say that about blues music, too.
Yeah, kind of.
I thought, oh, that'd make a good song. And then in the lyrics of the song, then I tried to use a lot of cliche bluegrass phrases and ideas. So each verse is sort of a different bluegrass cliche, and that's sort of how that came to be.
There's only one bluegrass song. Sing it all night long. It's just a little ballad by the girl who done me wrong. There's only one bluegrass song.
I guess what you have to do is listen to the instrumentation. That's where the appreciation comes through.
Part of that is also part of its appeal, that you know what you're getting usually. A lot of bluegrass fans are also musicians, and so they like to play the songs, and they're very accessible. You know, the chord structures are usually pretty similar, and, you know, if you're going to sit around and have a bluegrass jam and you've never heard of the song, as soon as someone starts playing it, you can kind of figure out what they're doing and play along. So part of that is part of its charm as well.
It's good campfire music.
Exactly.
Jim Nelson with us, lives in Menominee. There's only one bluegrass song. That's the name of his newest album. Guest musicians supplied their parts. Jake and Danny Soha, they call themselves the Rock Creek Song Dogs. I should let people know they're going to be guests on the show next week.
Yeah, Jake and Danny are good friends of mine. For maybe a year or two, I played in their group as their guitar player. And been down to their Buffalo Rivers studio down in Mondovi, sent him a few of the songs, and he plays a little banjo, a little mandolin on a couple of the songs, some background vocals. That was nice to have them. And then Royce said, I have this fiddle player, turned out to be John Utball, a local musician, plays in a lot of groups.
And you had a guest guitarist, Aubrey King, as well on the CD.
Yeah, he's someone who I don't even know, have never met. I contacted him through a bluegrass guitar Facebook group, and he was advertising the fact that he does this. He'll record a guitar track. He's really good. So mm-hmm. I contacted him, the second song called Gone Long Gone. And so there's a guitar solo on there near the end, and he just nailed it. Aubrey King from, I think he lives in Florida.
What a sign of the times, huh?
Yeah, no
you can
kidding.
Get people on your album who you've never met. Jim Nelson, it's called There's Only One Bluegrass Song. Jim, thanks for taking the time. Thanks for sending the CD, and please keep us posted on what's going on, especially after we pass that new morning.
Absolutely. The pleasure's been all mine.
See ya.
Thanks, Al.
I'm driving down the road, still the long hot summer night keeps dragging on. With 100 miles behind, here comes another sign telling me that my good gal is gone. Yeah, she's gone, gone, long gone. Yeah, she's gone.
Yes, Siri, there's only one bluegrass song, and there's only one fruitcake, right, that circles the world every holiday season. Ah, you know, when Willie Porter plays, you just let him keep it up. Until you have to dive in and tell you that that's it for this week. Coming up next week, Jerry Way entertains us. We'll also meet, as I said earlier, the Rock Creek Song Dogs. We're also going to talk about the pickleball craze and more. Thanks to Kate, Dean, Tommy, and you. I invite you to visit WPR.org to find Spectrum West Archive there. Texas may be big, but their willpower is small. So show them what Wisconsin strong and Wisconsin smart is. Wear a mask, be good to one another, and whenever and wherever possible, make a positive difference. Will you? See you next week.